Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Right to Counsel Post-Decision Edition. Thanks for tuning in. On Tuesday, May 26th, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Montejo v. Louisiana. In this case, the Supreme Court considered whether a criminal defendant is protected by the Sixth Amendment right to counsel when he has not taken any affirmative step to invoke said right and has not indicated his acceptance of his court-appointed attorney. Michigan v. Jackson, the controlling precedent, had assumed that anyone with a court-appointed attorney had already affirmatively invoked their right to counsel, ignoring the fact that many states appoint counsel automatically. Finding that this logic could not be reconciled with the facts of the instant case, the Supreme Court overturned Michigan v. Jackson in a 5-4 decision delivered by Justice Scalia and remanded the case for further proceedings. To discuss the decision, we welcome University of San Diego law professor Michael Rappaport. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Rappaport.
In Montejo versus Louisiana, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, overruled Michigan versus Jackson. In 1986, Jackson had announced a Sixth Amendment rule forbidding the police from questioning a criminal defendant once the defendant had requested a lawyer at an arraignment or similar proceeding. With the overruling of Jackson, the police may attempt to question criminal defendants who have lawyers so long as the defendant's decision to speak with the police is voluntary, knowing, and intelligent, and the police have complied with Miranda requirements. In Montejo, Jesse Montejo had been arrested for murder and had been brought before a judge for a 72-hour preliminary hearing. At the hearing, the court ordered an attorney to represent Montejo. Significantly, Montejo had not requested an attorney and did not say anything when the court announced the appointment of his attorney. Later that day, Montejo was visited in prison by two police detectives, was read his Miranda rights, waived those rights, and then wrote an inculpatory letter of apology to the victim's widow. Only afterward did Montejo meet his court-appointed attorney. Montejo was convicted of first-degree murder, in part based on the inculpatory letter written during the interrogation without his attorney. The Supreme Court initially granted certiorari to determine whether the Jackson rule, prohibiting the questioning of a defendant without his attorney, should be applied to defendants like Montejo, who had been given an attorney but had never requested one. Subsequently, the court, on its own, requested additional briefing as to whether the Jackson case should be overruled. Now, the Supreme Court's analysis can be divided into two parts. First, the majority interpreted its earlier decision in Jackson to cover only defendants who had requested an attorney, not defendants who merely had one appointed for them without requesting it. The court believed that the defendant's request for an attorney was essential to applying the Jackson rule. If a defendant had requested the appointment of an attorney, then it's a reasonable assumption that he would not want to speak to the police outside of the lawyer's presence. But if he had not requested the attorney, one could not make that assumption. According to the majority, the point of Jackson was to prevent the police from badgering the defendant into giving up his right to have his attorney present. But that was not a danger for those defendants who had never requested an attorney. Justice Stevens, writing for four members of the court, disagreed with this view of Jackson. He claimed that Jackson was not merely about preventing the defendant from being badgered by the police, but instead was about protecting the defendant's Sixth Amendment right to have a lawyer advise him about his actions. Under Stevens' view, once the defendant had secured a lawyer, the defendant was entitled to have his attorney advise him about whether to speak to the police, and therefore the police could not contact the defendant directly. Once the majority had concluded that Jackson only applied to defendants who had requested an attorney, the question was how to apply Jackson in the more than half of the states that appointed an attorney even when the defendant had not requested one. The majority perceived significant problems with applying Jackson in these circumstances, and that led it to consider and then to conclude that Jackson should be overruled. Relying on precedent, the court considered four factors in whether Jackson should be overruled. First, the court concluded that Jackson would be unworkable in those states that appointed an attorney even when the defendant had not requested one. The difficulty in those states is determining whether the defendant desired the attorney. One way to deal with this issue was to make the determination on a case-by-case basis, but the court believed that this would both create uncertainty and be costly to administer. Another way to deal with the issue was to apply a categorical rule, such as triggering Jackson only when the defendant had requested the attorney. But such a rule would not be desirable because it would arbitrarily confer the Jackson protections on defendants in states which induce the defendant to ask for an attorney, but not in other states. Two other factors that were relevant to overruling precedents, the precedent's antiquity and the reliance interests at stake, also supported overruling Jackson. The case was only 2 decades old, and the overruling would not upset the legitimate expectations of criminal defendants. The court argued that any criminal defendant learned enough to order his affairs based on Jackson would also be capable of interacting with the police on his own without an attorney. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, the court argued that the reasoning that led to Jackson was weak. Since the Jackson rule did not identify the scope of Sixth Amendment rights, but instead was designed as a prophylactic rule to protect those rights, the court believed that the quality of the reasoning in Jackson turned on a comparison of the benefits and costs of the Jackson rule. The court concluded that the benefits of the rule were small. The rule would not do much to protect defendants from being badgered by the police because most defendants were already protected by several prophylactic rules established by Miranda and its progeny. In particular, when a defendant is taken into custody, he must be given his Miranda rights, and once he asks to see his lawyer, the questioning must stop, and no subsequent interrogations can take place without his counsel. By contrast, the costs of Jackson were significant. Jackson would nullify voluntary confessions given after Miranda warnings had been provided, and therefore impede the conviction of the guilty. Of course, the dissenters disagreed with this characterization of the reasoning in Jackson. Most significantly, they emphasized that there was no empirical evidence that the Jackson rule had created problems, and they believed that the Jackson rule would contribute significantly to the protection of the defendant's rights. In a case like Monteo's, he would have benefited from having a lawyer available to advise him on the consequences of speaking to the police. But Justice Scalia here took issue with the dissent. In particular, he saw the Jackson rule as excessively protecting defendants against the possibility that they would voluntarily confess. As Justice Scalia put it, and I quote here, "Miranda and the cases that elaborate upon it already guarantee not simply non-coercion in the traditional sense, but what Justice Holland referred to as voluntariness with a vengeance. There is no need to take Jackson's further step of requiring voluntariness on stilts," end quote. The Monteo case raises a number of wider implications. First, the case is politically salient, since it involves the foremost conservative justices, along with Justice Kennedy, overruling what is considered to be a liberal decision in the criminal procedure area over the dissents of the foremost liberal justices. The case is also significant because the two newest justices signed on to the overruling. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito have in certain cases been less willing to join broad decisions that overrule prior cases. Yet in this case, they joined the majority decision. Perhaps the reason these institutionally minded justices supported the overruling here is that they believed that Jackson was not merely wrong, but unworkable. A third significant issue is whether this decision suggests a relaxation of the standards for overruling prior cases. But there is no real evidence of any change in these standards. Rather, what seems to divide the majority and the dissent is their disagreement over the strength of the reasoning in Jackson. Fourth, the case raises the issue of the arbitrariness of the use of precedent. Critics of precedent sometimes argue that precedent rules are applied in an inconsistent, result-oriented way. Interestingly, Justice Alito, in a separate concurrence, accuses some of the dissenters of inconsistency. Since they voted in April to overrule the decision in Arizona versus Gantt, in circumstances where Justice Alito believed the case for overruling was weaker than in Monteo. In response, Justice Stevens defends himself and accuses Justice Alito of inconsistency for failing to vote in favor of precedent in Monteo. Finally, the case also raises the question whether the more originalist justices are willing to dispense with precedent to pursue the original meaning. Some academic originalists, such as Gary Lawson and Mike Carlson, believe that precedent should count for little. Others, like myself and John McGinnis, believe in a more intermediate approach. But neither approach is followed by the Supreme Court here, which employs a strong presumption in favor of precedent. In fact, Justice Scalia's opinion did not even argue that Jackson was wrong because it was inconsistent with the original meaning. Instead, he accepted the view of the non-originalist precedent and merely argued that Jackson's costs were greater than its benefits. Thus, while the Monteo decision probably moved the court closer to the original meaning by overturning Jackson, the case cannot really be seen as a significant step towards a more originalist, less precedent-oriented jurisprudence.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.